bringing Southern California together for nearly five decades. This is Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. 95.5 KLOS. Now, Spotlight on the Community with Doug McIntyre.
Joining us right now is the supervisor from Orange County. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show, Todd Spitzer. Good morning, Mr. Spitzer. How are you?
I'm great. Good morning.
Thanks for coming on with us. So,
absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That videotape that we all saw, and I'm sure that you've seen too many times, was shocking only in the magnitude. There are variations on that theme all over Southern California in particular, all over the country, but all over Southern California in particular. And I guess the question is, did the program begin yesterday, and how did it go, and where does it stand?
Well, I was down there for 3 hours yesterday. Yesterday was the first day of actually clearing the encampment. So we posted the notice, the legal notice, that we were going to be clearing the riverbed on January 8th. And, you know, a lot of people had moved out in anticipation of yesterday. But there's a lot of hardcore individuals out there who have been there for a very, very long time. So it's going to take a lot of, prodding and coaxing, if you will. When we closed the Fountain Valley portion of the riverbed 6 weeks ago, it took us 8 days to clear out that area, and that area was four times smaller than this area.
Wow. Now, Todd, could you walk us through some of what, because this problem, it seems like, well, what's the big deal? You bring in some fire hoses, you move people out, blah, blah, blah. But there's all kinds of laws and rights that must be respected. For instance, the word was that six storage containers, a big roll-off, cargo containers, were brought down to secure the personal possessions of people who were being evicted. You know, and a lot of that stuff, the city of L.A. was spending a fortune with warehouses filled with this stuff, and some of it is just filthy. It's just vermin-infested feces and every other nasty thing. What are the legal obligations of the county in terms of taking possession of this stuff, and how long do you have to keep it, and does anybody ever come back to reclaim it?
So we do have three sites along the riverbed, Cotella, Santa Ana, and Chapman. We are required to store it. We will store for a period of 90 days. After 90 days, if it's unclaimed, we'll consider it abandoned and it will be disposed of. The court has allowed us to use, you know, good judgment and distinguish between what is trash and what appears to be somebody's possession. But as you know, when you're down on your means, you know, the old expression, right, another man's trash is another man's treasure. So it's, you know, it's sometimes hard to distinguish. But I think the point here is that we have been, since July of last year, we have had social services through CityNet in a motorhome parked at the riverbed, offering anybody and everybody who wants services to get services. We've moved 165 individuals off the riverbed. But this is the distinction. And I think the public understands, and I think public sentiment is moving in my direction, which is, let's be compassionate, let's be empathetic, let's be considerate. But at some point, you can't force somebody to help themselves. And what's happening is this is now violating people's property rights who live along the riverbed, who rent along the riverbed, who recreate. And let's not forget, this is our flood channel, okay? This carries hundreds of thousands of acre feet of water during our flood season from all the various, you know, other locations, from the mountains and everything else that go to the sea. Plus, this is the recharge basin for Orange County's underwater drinking, groundwater. And so I can't have 4,500 needles that we recovered in that area. I can't have hepatitis. I can't have feces and urine and all these things contaminating my riverway. And so we're trying to be compassionate, but we also have to put our foot down. There has to be this kind of dictate that tells people you're not going to live there.
Now, how many people took up the county on relocation services, and how many people, and the ones who didn't, where did they go?
Well, so of the number out there, 464 were frequent inhabitants, but who would not take the services. You know, there's been this big argument that there isn't enough beds, there isn't enough this, there isn't enough that. But when we offered these services over the course of 6 months, we didn't have as many takers as you would think. In fact, 9 out of 10 individuals living on the riverbed said they prefer their lifestyle and they want to be left alone.
We're talking with Orange County Supervisor Todd Spitzer. Todd, let me ask a provocative question. Is it not in our interest as a society to criminalize vagrancy and to build special prisons? And I'm going to use the P word. That's what they are, prisons, because now if we make vagrancy a crime, then you are being incarcerated for committing the crime of vagrancy. And when people are picked up for vagrancy, they are forcibly removed to live in a county-run or state-run or municipal-run facility that would include services, including psychiatric, drug and alcohol counseling, etc. But I can't help but feel, as long as it's legal to live on the street and to go feral, we're going to have X percentage out of a third of a billion people in the population. We're going to end up with X percentage of the public is going to take us up on it. And we're seeing this increasingly across America, not just here in Southern California, where it's ideal because the weather's better.
Well, you remember we locked people up because of their mental condition. We used to call those, insane asylums.
Uh-huh.
I think we've progressed a lot as a society about how we deal with our mentally ill. I'm not there in terms of that particular suggestion. I can tell you this, and I think it's a problem facing all of Southern California. How am I going to continue to build affordable housing in the numbers that individuals who need to be served who are currently living on the street in places like Orange County or Los Angeles where land is so expensive? In other words, how does the government, how do the taxpayers even afford this? Why aren't we coming together as a region, all the large counties, so San Diego, Ventura, Riverside, Los Angeles, San Bernardino, and saying we all have this problem, why don't we pull our resources and build housing and facilities in an area where land is so much cheaper and more plentiful? That's the question I think we should be asking, because right now we're all dealing with this on an individual basis. Look, Skid Row, I grew up in L.A. I grew up in Montebello. I worked in downtown Los Angeles. Skid Row has been there my entire adult life in downtown Los Angeles. I am not about to, as an elected official in Orange County, allow what has happened in Los Angeles to happen in Orange County. And I think once you allow these kinds of encampments to take place, that they do just grow and they just do multiply. And they're terrible for business. They're terrible for people who are just trying to make a living and get along as well.
They're terrible for the people living there. Well, that's
right.
I feel like, and again, I mean, I'm not sure what the solution here is either, but, and I know it sounds draconian, but I just feel like it's a false compassion to allow people to live on a riverbed, in a wash, or under a freeway overpass. Coming down here this morning, and we leave obviously very early in the morning, I mean hours before sunup, to go on the air at 5 in the morning. And it's cold. And I passed 50 people living under overpasses driving down here. And to me, to allow that to continue is a false compassion, forcibly removing people.
I break this into three groups. I break it into the criminal element that's living in these on our streets because the state legislature has decriminalized almost every
pretty much everything in the state. Uh-huh.
So let's take a third that honestly should be in jail or prison based upon their criminal history. And they are really being an inhibitor to people getting services. Then there's people like my cousin Patsy, who is a paranoid schizophrenic, and she will never be able to hold down a job, and she will never be normal. And so we have to deal with the mentally ill. And so that's another third. And then there's a third that just is engaged in a lifestyle that they've grown accustomed, and they need to be self-sufficient. They need to work. They need to get a job. So I believe that about a third of it, really the mentally ill and those who have addictive behavior, that's where we should be focusing on our energy, because that's our responsibility as a safety net to take care of those people. But the others are either criminals or and should be in prison, but they're not because of the crazy laws we're being faced with today. And the other are just there because they prefer to be lazy.
Well, I agree to a point. I guess my point is that as a civil society, as a matter of public health and just in order to get control of this issue, I just think the first step has to be removing people from the streets, period. And then you can separate them into the three categories. And those that belong in jail should be returned to jail. Those who need mental treatment should be provided facilities and treatment. And those who need a kick in the ass should get the kick in the ass. Otherwise, we're just – because this is so expensive. I mean, what we're doing now is expensive and it's dangerous. It's dangerous to the communities and it's dangerous to the first responders who have to have contact with people with the hepatitis outbreaks. And it's dangerous for the people who are living under these conditions and living a feral lifestyle that is puts their lives in constant jeopardy.
Well, people are dying on the riverbed, and they're dying in disproportionate numbers. And that's one of the reasons when I get told, well, people are dying, and that's exactly why we need to close the riverbed, right? Because it's not safe. It's a public safety issue, and it's not safe. It's not safe for the public. It's not safe for the people living there. But I do hope you agree with me, and we'll continue to talk about the fact that all of Southern California, the elected officials, faith-based community, profit, nonprofit, need to get together and have a summit on the homeless and decide where we're going to triage these people. Because you can't do it in one of the most expensive places in the nation.
I totally agree. And this is, you know, this is the same issue with low-income housing. It's hard to build low-income housing when the land you're building it on is some of the most expensive land in the nation.
That's right.
Hey,
that's right.
Thank you so much for your time, and I appreciate
you.
The conversation. Todd Spitzer, Orange County Supervisor. Over the weekend, a surprise announcement came from Chief Charlie Beck.
Today, I am announcing that as of June 27th of this year, I'll be retiring from my position of Chief of Police. As you all know, I am very invested in this organization. You know, I am not a member of the LAPD. I am the LAPD. It is my DNA.
I am the LAPD?
Well, I think the LAPD will go on beyond Charlie Beck, but his 40-year career will come to an end in the end of June. Joining us right now to talk about it is the president of the Los Angeles Police Protective League. Welcome back to the show, Craig Lally. Craig, how are you?
Hey, Todd. Good morning.
Thank you for being with us. Appreciate it. What's your reaction? Did you have any heads up that this was about to happen?
No, actually, I was just getting off a plane from San Francisco and landed in Burbank, and my phone started blowing up when I turned it back on. But, you know, a year and a half to go on his second five-year term, so I knew eventually he was going to leave. Actually, he's just leaving a year early because he's we're not going to have an interim chief, so he'll be here for the next 6 months. And I want to commend the chief. He was here for over 40 years with the LAPD, and I wish him well in his retirement.
He hasn't said the reason why he's leaving, except that he said that you can't ride the bull forever. You got to know when to get off the bull. But he's had some serious health issues, including some bone breaks that were very serious. Is there any possibility that contributed to the decision?
I've never heard that, to be honest with you, from anybody, either in the police department or with the other directors. So I don't think that's the reason, because I get a lot of rumors throughout the department, and that wasn't one of them.
The chief also, by the way, in his retirement announcement, talked about rumors, and this was kind of an interesting thing. Play that, if you will.
This is my decision. It has nothing to do with any issue, scandal, anything other than me trying to pick the right time to leave. I can't stay forever, and I can't stay any time past 2019, in November of 19. But it's not healthy to take it up to the last day and put the city in a bind about picking the next chief.
You see, I don't quite follow the logic here, because the city knows exactly when Chief Beck would be leaving if he serves out his full term, because it's mandated that he can only serve 2 5-year terms. So they certainly knew what his exit date would be and then could plan accordingly and not have it become a last minute thing. So, but that's neither here nor there. For whatever reason, the chief has made his decision to leave now. And then the question is, where do we go from here? Does the PPL have preference in terms of would the PPL philosophically rather have somebody come from within the current department, or is an outside chief from outside the agency acceptable?
Well, you know what? It's going to be a long process. They'll have 6 months to get this right. The process is have a nationwide search. I think the last time they narrowed it down to 12 applicants, and then the final three went to the mayor for his approval. So it's going to be a long process. I just hope the new chief is committed to continue to reduce the violent crime. And I really think we need a chief that's an advocate for the police officers and a strong advocate for the police officers. Because, you know, Doug, we're very, very undermanned here. We have 10,000 officers. We should have at least 13,000. We're doing the best we can with the resources we have available, and it's going to be a tough whoever takes that position.
We're talking with Craig Lally, who's the president of the Los Angeles Police Protective League. LAPD.com is a website for the LAPD, obviously. Craig, the chief is a police officer first and foremost, but it's also a very, very difficult political position, because when you're the chief of the Los Angeles Police Department, virtually any city police department, but definitely this city, you are, in addition to the chief law enforcement officer of the city, you are a spokesperson for the values of the city, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I have had a disagreement over Special Order 40, essentially, for my entire 30-plus years in the city of Los Angeles. I don't think it makes the city safer. That's my personal opinion, and others disagree. The next chief undoubtedly is going to be a backer of sanctuary policies. That's just the reality. So if anybody thinks that the next chief is going to be all of a sudden going to appoint Joe Arpaio to be the chief of the LAPD, whatever you're smoking, that ain't medical or recreational pot. That's something else. That's just never going to happen. But it really is a difficult challenge to be the chief of police of Los Angeles, because this is an incredibly diversified city with a lot of competing interests, and the chief has to find that balance. It's not easy.
You know what? You're absolutely right, Doug. Back in, I've been on since Gerald Gates, 37 years ago. And back then, the one thing that Gerald Gates had was he didn't have term limits, and he can basically be chief and not politician. And as we move forward, it's a lot more politics involved than when I first came on the department when Gerald Gates was the chief. So you're absolutely correct on that. A lot of it is politics. No matter who the next chief is going to be. But that's what we're stuck with. We have no control over that.
Yep, it really is. It's going to be an interesting process to see who ends up in that position, especially given the multiple challenges in the Black Lives Matter movement. And at any time, and this is the thing about the job of being chief of police in a major city, on any given day, an incident can happen that can completely change the culture of a city. It's that inflammatory. It really is. I mean, tensions are high, and you just don't know what could happen somewhere that can just send everything sideways. I mean, it's maybe one of the most important decisions that Eric Garcetti will make as mayor of Los Angeles. Craig, thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it, as always.
Yeah, pleasure to be on your show again, Doug. Take care.
Thanks so much. We circle back to a story that obviously the whole world was scratching their head saying, how in the world does this happen? The Paris parents, the David and Louise Turpin, out in Paris, California, with the 13 kids that they were holding hostage, and more bizarre details coming out of that, including apparently their move from Texas to California was so that they could be closer to Hollywood, because Louise Turpin, the mom, thought, we're a reality show.
Yeah.
She was obsessed with K plus 8.
That's right.
And they may have been breeding for
that.
You know, it actually rhymes. Terpene plus 13.
Yeah. Oh, they may have been having kids in the hope of getting a reality show. And
Crazy. Folks,
that's just the tip of the iceberg. Yeah. To talk to us about this, clinical and forensic psychologist, Dr. Judy Ho. Dr. Ho, how are you?
Hi, guys. Good morning.
Morning.
So, Dr. Judy, we got the sister now. This is Teresa Robinette, who is, Louise Turpin's sister. And she's talking about this bizarre sex road trip that David and Louise Turpin took. Listen to this.
She told me that her and David had met a man online from Huntsville, Alabama, and that they were on their way there to meet him, and that she was going to sleep with him. And what makes it even worse and even weirder is that exactly 1 year to the date of the anniversary that she did that, David, she called me and thought it was funny that David was taking her back to the exact same hotel room, the exact same hotel, everything, the exact same bed that she slept with this man in, so that David could sleep with her in the same bed.
And
not gold much.
And of course, there's also this doozy detail.
A very, very close family member that we should have loved and trusted. He abused my mother and sexually abused my mother. And then me and Louise Elizabeth and a few of our cousins in the family, that was a situation that was ongoing for me and my sisters.
Now, does that come as a surprise, Dr. Judy, that there would be a history of sexual abuse in this family?
You know, it really doesn't. And I think as more and more details unfold, you can see that this is obviously a family that has a really terrible history of abuse. And we see this oftentimes with individuals who have been abused themselves, that they perpetuate the abuse. And it's not an excuse. It's just one of the things that we see from research, that individuals who have been abused, about 30 to 35% of them do go on to abuse their own children. And perhaps there's something here about, you know, not having ever learned how it is to trust another person, and something about the way that Louise was so fixated on, for example, becoming a star in a reality show. The children are just like, they're not human beings. They're just things for her to use to be able to reach her goals. And we sometimes see that in really severely abused children, that because they don't trust other people, they end up kind of looking at other people just as means to an end instead of having real pro-social relationships with them.
You know, one of the things I guess people, I've, to a certain amount, I zoned out, but there's this picture of all the kids and they're wearing these matching red shirts and it says thing.
Thing one, thing two.
And it just jumps in when you talk about they don't see them as human beings. Yeah. Well, the parents had, whether they meant it or it was subliminal or whatever, but they would literally label their children as things as opposed to human beings.
That's exactly right. And even though it is a Dr. Seuss reference, it's interesting that they chose that particular reference, right? And in general, that's obviously not the only time that we've seen the parents sort of order them in size, in height, in age, wearing all the same things. And so they're not really celebrating each child's individuality, and that's obviously not the point. And there's been neighbors who have reported that they've actually seen glimpses of them being marched around in the middle of the night across their windows. And there's this huge sense of control and a huge sense of basically we're the ones in charge and we don't want you to develop any of your own mindsets. I think what's obviously curious, though, is that throughout the years, they have been in very small controlled portions allowing their children out in public spaces, still very much under their control, but there is still a little bit of that persona on the outside, which I think is why so many people just didn't think to report this family, even though they thought it was odd.
Dr. Judy, you know, there have been reports that David Turpin had actually kidnapped Louise from high school when she was 16 years old and had actually taken her to Texas from West Virginia before they found them. He wanted to elope with her, but then they brought him back to West Virginia where he actually convinced the family. They thought maybe he was Prince Charming, was going to give her this great life. And they said, okay, you can marry her. And then, you know, obviously this life sort of went downhill. I do blame her. I mean, obviously she's an adult and she should have known better. So I, you know, they're both to blame. But do you find at all that possibly she was also a victim here?
Oh, absolutely. That's a really good point. So sometimes we do see individuals who have had checkered childhoods, sufferers of abuse, you know, they have a lot of difficulty identifying who they are, establishing self-esteem, understanding that they're important. And then all of a sudden,
David shows up in her life and she feels important. She feels like this is finally my ticket out of perhaps the misery of her life up until that point. And they are much more easily swayed because they haven't had that opportunity to truly identify who they are and really engage in that identity development. And so in the beginning, she was probably glamorized by him to some degree and then sort of went along with what he was doing. But also what's scary is because she had such a shaky childhood and probably not very good, stable adult figures, it's also very easy for her just to take on the identity of whoever she's with. Mm-hmm. So if David is sort of the instigator and had all of these horrible psychopathic ideas, it's not going to be long before Louise actually adopts those ideas for herself. It's sort of like a really quick way to just modeling and adopting everything that David believes.
We're talking with Dr. Judy Ho, clinical and forensic psychologist at Dr. Judy Ho. Now, here's the gazillion-dollar question, and I guess that this is somewhat similar to the school shooting story, whether it was in Kentucky or in Texas the day before that. What do we ever learn anything when one of these bizarre scenarios is uncovered that actually helps us in the future? Because it seems like, you know, crazy is what crazy does. And you know, every one of these bizarre situations, there's some broad stroke commonalities, but for the most part, the insanity sort of is a one-off. They're all sort of an experimental vehicle, right, if you will.
Yes, and you know, I think history does show us that sometimes with these horrible types of tragedies, when we uncover them, you know, even though we try to do this backwards analysis, there's sometimes very little that led up to it. There's very little that we can do. But I do think that in this scenario, as in other cases, there's usually the commonality of some level of secrecy, at least some level of odd talk and odd beliefs that were expressed at some point, whether, you know, on social media or written or just to a family member or friend. And I really encourage people, and I know this is a little bit against our culture, you know, we tend to like to leave people alone. We're a very individualistic culture. But if you see something concerning, even if it's just slightly concerning, just knowing how many children die, for example, from child abuse on a daily basis, it's about 5 in this country every single day. So what? Just report it to the police for a welfare check, and the worst happens, nothing's wrong, and you're just a bit embarrassed. But the best thing that could happen is you could save a life, right? And I think, you know, if we can just be a little bit more prompted to say, hey, if I do see something suspicious, just report to the authorities and let them check it out. I think that would be a good step.
Agreed wholeheartedly. You know, I want to talk about the 17-year-old girl who they said since she was 15 years old, for 2 years, she had been planning and plotting to escape somehow, to get away from, either get out of the chains or the ropes or out of, you know, get out of the house when she wasn't watched, and she had to climb through a window. And at first they said she convinced a sister to go with her who got scared and ran back into the house. But she was able to grab a phone that was actually not even connected to service, but that did have a battery power. She actually took pictures of the house because she was afraid that when she did call 911 that they might not believe her. She actually got away and called the cops and said, we need help, that we're being held against our will, and I have pictures to prove it. What can you say about her? I mean, of all of the others, she's in the middle. She's not even the oldest. She's not the youngest. But what about her personality and planning it for 2 years? What does it say about her and her personality and her demeanor for planning this and being the strong one of the children to be able to do this?
Well, Leanne, I just think this girl is amazing, because when you imagine what she was up against, not only was she up against this idea of groupthink, because remember, these children were raised like this all their lives, mm-hmm. so they don't even know any better. I would imagine that at least some of these children have like a sense of Stockholm syndrome, where they actually believe their parents are loving them and providing for them, that this is sort of the way the world is. And so not only is she battling that groupthink, she's also battling the fact that all of these children have cognitive impairments because they were severely starved and abused. And so we know that in general, they're not operating in terms of problem-solving styles at their chronological age. You know, their cognitive capacity is just so diminished from all of the torture and starvation. And so she's sort of going to put this plan together, and she doesn't really have a teenager's brain. I mean, she may have possibly the cognitive function of an elementary school child, right? And still having to fight through this idea that this is perhaps torture and not good parents. You know, it's really amazing. Of course, she actually took off with another child, but then the other child got scared and ran back home, right?
Yeah.
So they just didn't really know, and she just kept going. So I just think that she is so strong, and I really believe in general for everybody in this family that there is hope. You know, they're getting them into professional care now and into the hands of hopefully more trustworthy adults. But especially this teenager, I really see great things for her. Not only is she going to be a leader for this family, but I believe that she's probably going to be able to help so many other abused children in the future, just being able to be a role model for them. And hey, you can get out and you can make a different life.
Follow Dr. Judy Ho on Twitter at Dr. Judy Ho. You're listening to Spotlight on the Community on 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre. Make sure you listen to McIntyre in the morning, weekdays 5 to 10 on Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.
Spotlight on the Community now resumes with Doug McIntyre.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, for two decades, I've been talking about the scourge of illegal immigration and our sanctuary city policy, Special Order 40, the grandfather of all, the granddaddy of all sanctuary policies, going back to 1979, then Chief Daryl Gates. And it's on now because we have an administration that is intent on not allowing California to follow in the footsteps of John C. Calhoun and invoke nullification. The president yesterday talked about the Department of Justice finally cracking down on sanctuary cities. This is what he had to say.
The Department of Justice today has announced a critical legal step to hold accountable sanctuary cities that violate federal law and free criminal aliens back into our communities. We can't have that. Can't have it. It would be very easy to go the other way, but we can't have it. We want a safe country.
And Mayor Garcetti basically said the president was just talking out of his hat.
These threats, I want to say this too, are nothing short of a distraction. Because when you're threatening people with things that aren't going to happen, if you don't listen to the police professionals of this nation as we do every day and understand how best to serve immigrant communities, if you're too pro-family to want to see families broken up by destructive immigration policies, if you're too pro-economy to stop the entrepreneurs, be they women who have been shut out for too long or immigrants who are part of founding our nation's new economy, then sure, distract this country from your lack of work, but the mayors are getting back to it.
So the mayor of Los Angeles is saying this is just a bunch of empty threats. Joining us right now is the acting director of ICE, Thomas Homan. Mr. Homan, are you making empty threats?
I'm not making any threats at all. I mean, people say I'm threatening California and I'm acting in retaliation to California. What I have said is that when you have a sanctuary city that releases criminal aliens back into the public, I have to, in response, send additional resources to those cities to do my job. And let me give you an example. When you're not a sanctuary city, I can have one officer sitting in a county jail processing 10 criminal illegal aliens per shift. But when you release them to the street, and we have to go and find them, then we have to arrest them either at a home or a place of business where they have access to who knows what weapons. Now that's not the job of one agent. Now that's the job of a team of five agents. So what I have said is not a retaliation for sanctuary cities. It's not a threat. Based on their decision to be a sanctuary city, I am required for operational effectiveness and for officer safety concerns to send more additional resources, and that is, in fact, happening.
I believe, and maybe I've just been covering L.A. too long in Southern California, I believe they want to see home raids and workplace raids because they want the videotape to put on the news to show how heartless and cruel the administration is for breaking up families, et cetera, et cetera. And that's exactly, this is a PR battle. This is a propaganda campaign. They actually want to see that happen.
Well, look, two things on that. First of all, if the message we want to send, because I keep hearing these, we're breaking up families or somebody's been here for a long time, has a U.S. citizen child. If we keep sending the message, you can go ahead and violate the laws of this country, enter the country illegally, which is a crime. Entering this country illegally is a crime. 8 United States Code 1325. Look it up. If we want to send a message, go ahead and violate the laws of this country. If you're lucky enough to get by the Border Patrol, have a child. And being born in this country, make that child a U.S. citizen. If by the very fact you enter the country looking to have a child, if if we want to send a message, now you're immune from law enforcement. Now you get amnesty. Then you're never going to solve the border crisis, and more people are going to die trying to come to this country. On the second issue, you know, it's all smoke and mirrors, the sanctuary cities. They say they want to protect the immigrant community. When I can't arrest a bad guy in the safety, security, and privacy of a county jail, as I said before, we have to go into the neighborhood and locate these people at their homes or place of business, where I will find other illegal aliens, because, you know, chances are if the target of criminal aliens, his family may be illegal, people he lives with may be illegal, which now here's people that weren't even on my radar are standing in front of our agents, and under executive orders, we no longer turn a blind eye to that. We will arrest those folks too. So Sanctuary City's policy actually put the immigrant community at greater risk of arrest by immigration officers. Not only does it put them at greater risk by arrest of immigration officers, it puts them directly in harm's way because criminal aliens are going to victimize the very communities they live in. Now, if you ask any immigrant community, would you rather have an ICE agent in your neighborhood or in a jail? What do you think they're going to say to you? They don't want criminals in their neighborhood either. They want us in the jail. And as far as this mis-messaging that, well, we're afraid people won't report crimes, we're afraid of victims. Look, ICE don't arrest victims that went to crimes. Matter of fact, there's an immigration benefit that can be awarded if they're a victim of a crime. Unless the police department is in the business of arresting and fingerprinting victims and witnesses, we don't even know they exist. Because most of the aliens come to our attention through the criminal justice system. They've been arrested and put in a jail.
We're talking with Thomas Homan, who's the acting director of ICE. Mr. Homan, what specifically is Los Angeles in for and other sanctuary cities and now the entire state of California? Because, you know, I have above and beyond the practical issue of whether or not sanctuary cities encourage people to come in the country illegally. But there's the issue, the constitutional issue of nullification, which I have grave concerns about, also on the legalized pot issue, that we've got a conflict between local law and federal law. We've got local laws that are nullifying federal law, and our entire system of government collapses if this continues.
Look, I think we're going to win this argument in courts. I agree with you 100%. A couple of things. I think what's going to happen in California, I think they're going to be litigated with the Department of Justice. I have asked the Department of Justice specifically to look at sanctuary cities. Are they in violation of federal statute, whether it's harboring illegal aliens in the jails, or is it a matter of not responding to, you know, 1373, which is a requirement under federal law to share, you know, information on illegal aliens? If you think about it, where we are today, I've been doing this for 34 years, and we're at the point now where a federal law enforcement officer whose job it is to enforce immigration law cannot walk into a taxpayer-funded jail to arrest somebody that is here illegally in violation of federal law and committed yet another crime. And for these mayors to say, well, ICE is, no, we can't let them in the jails because they're putting their hands on everybody, even low-level offenders. Well, if they're such a low-level offender, if they're so innocent, why are they sitting in a county jail? So local law enforcement thought it was important enough to arrest them and put them in a cell because either a public safety threat or a flight risk. So what changes when ICE shows up at the door? Nothing. So, you know, this argument that, you know, ICE isn't doing the right thing. They're not prioritizing criminals. If you look at our FY17 roll-up report, 89%, 9 out of every 10 aliens we arrested last year had a criminal history.
Listen,
the
problem, as I see it from this perspective out here in the West Coast, is that all of the facts are on your side, all of the facts. The problem is that we've had an accommodating media that has literally driven the getaway car in this issue. You can't get the Los Angeles Times to even use the term illegal immigrant. The Associated Press won't let reporters use the term illegal alien or illegal immigrant. It has to be an immigrant in the country illegally. They've taken the language away as if the term itself is hate speech. So, you know, in addition to the logic of what the law is and the net effect of this, one of the things that we're up against is essentially a relentless propaganda campaign.
100% accurate, and that's why I jump at the opportunity to talk to folks like you on the radio and do as many TV interviews as I can, live interviews. For instance, I did an interview yesterday. I was interviewed 20 minutes. I think I got 10-second cut when they actually aired it, and nothing I said made it. I can have an interview with certain media outlets and say ABC, and that night I'll turn the TV on and I hear D, E, and F. So that's why people like you, shows like this, I jump at the chance. I clear my calendar to talk to folks so I can talk uninterrupted. People can hear my words. because I think if people hear the honest, true facts of what we're trying to do and what we do, and more importantly, what we don't do, they start to understand. For that, blue-collar worker sitting at a dinner table who doesn't really understand this whole issue, that's the people I'm trying to get to. Look, I'm never convinced the politicians who put politics over public safety that what I'm saying is accurate. They're never going to admit it. I'm talking to the taxpayer, the American citizen out there who's been victimized by criminal illegal aliens, and explain to them, look, we're a nation of laws. I can't blame anybody to want to be part of the greatest nation on earth. But there's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it. You can't want to be a part of the greatest nation on earth and not respect its laws. You can't have it both ways, not anymore. So, you know, what I'm saying, I think I've been doing this a long time. I'm a cop. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a politician. I'm a 34-year police, a law enforcement officer who's just speaking the fact, black and white, and let people make their own determination.
Listen, Abraham Lincoln many years ago said this nation cannot survive half slave and half free. I believe it cannot survive half legal and half illegal. And this is the time to fix the problem. But we can't do it through all of this political correctness and just outright lies. Thank you for coming on, sir. Yes. You're always welcome on the show. Thomas Homan, acting director of ICE. Because California has legalized recreational marijuana along with medical marijuana, the pot business is booming, and, of course, that means not just mom-and-pop pot operations, but Big Agra is going to get into the game, and an alliance of California marijuana growers has filed suit to try to prevent large corporations from coming in and devastating the pot market for the smaller farmers. Let's talk about this right now with the executive director of the California Growers Association, Hezekiah Allen. Hezekiah, how are you?
Great to be here this morning.
Appreciate it. So how do you define a small grower?
So, you know, what we're really looking at here is language that was in Prop 64 that says that for the first 5 years of regulated cannabis, there won't be large licenses. Large cultivation in this case means more than an acre in cultivation.
Well, that is obviously very small. Obviously, if you had a farm that was growing 1 acre of soybeans, you wouldn't be dominating the market. But as we know, modern American farming in many ways, while there's boutique farms now, organics and stuff like that, for the most part, it's industrial-sized farming, and it could be thousands and thousands of acres in cultivation. And with this kind of money on the table, it seems obvious that at some point the big boys are going to want to get in there, and those tractors are going to be going through the pot fields.
But here's the thing about all those other commodities. They're sold all over the world. California is an agricultural powerhouse. Cannabis can only be sold in the state. And this is really the until federal policy is reformed, until this product can be sold on the market like any one of those other products, we've got some really challenging problems to deal with. And I'll just give you a quick figure here. We estimate, and Rand Corporation also has put this estimate on the table, it's only going to take about 2,000 to 5,000 acres to supply all of California. We've already got 10,000 or more acres in cultivation. So we've got some pretty serious reckoning to do here.
You know, this is an issue. We've talked a lot about this, and I'm a libertarian on this issue. I don't believe that pot should be a criminal offense. I think it should be a legal activity for consenting adults, subject to all the rules and regulations of, you know, alcohol. So,
yep.
So, you know, and I know that that's your position as well. So we've got no quibble there. Where my concern is, I do have grave concerns about California basically nullifying federal law. Now, in this particular case, I would like to see federal law be changed to reflect California law. But I don't believe that California or any state can continue to go down the road that we're going, where we're passing laws that are in conflict with the federal law because the entire system of government. Then what happens if a county decides they don't want to listen to Sacramento, or a city doesn't want to listen to a county, or an individual says, I don't want to listen to the city? And the next thing you know, we basically just have chaos.
And we do. I mean, let's look at California right now. 70% of the counties are not in line with Sacramento. Several of those counties are appealing directly to Washington, D.C. for support. There are cities, hundreds of cities that are, you know, in varying arrangements from the counties. I mean, for all practical purposes, that mess is exactly what we're living with right now. And you know, Prop 64 included that five-year transition period, that five-year delay on big grows, in large part to give us some time to try to sort that out. And I agree entirely. We need the federal government. We need Congress to act. We need to address the fact that the majority of the American people feel like you and I do, feel like this should be a regulated activity for consenting adults. And our government needs to reflect that. So, you know, it's really trying to keep some of those bigger, more commercial-oriented interests at bay for a few years while we try to sort out some of these bigger problems.
The website, by the way, is calgrowerassociation.com. Now, at some point, presumably, I don't know if it'll be in my lifetime, but at some point, I think the federal law will be changed and it will be legal to grow, smoke, and sell pot and transport it throughout all the 50 states. Now, when that happens, at that time, inevitably, with so much money on the table as we go full circle, I think that your point is well made that right now it's not legal to transport California pot out of state. But at some point, those barriers will come down. And then how do you ever keep the big boys out?
I mean, at that point, you don't. And at that point, I think the public interest in doing so is reduced. You know, small farms are good for California. And that doesn't mean there shouldn't be big farms. It means there should be a place for both. The question is, how can we strike that balance with the market restrictions that we're facing? And so we would not be making this argument if this product were regulated at the federal level. There just wouldn't be a need to. We could all go out into the marketplace, compete, and let market forces decide. But we're not in a situation where the free market can prevail because we've got this strange overlay of disagreeing laws.
We had a conversation. We have a regular conversation with members of Congress on the show, and we were chatting with Tom McClintock of Sacramento, who's a very conservative Republican in California. And McClintock, not a fan of pot, but he was very insistent that he would support legalization at the federal level because he's also a libertarian on this and doesn't believe that we should impose a prohibition on a free people who don't want the law. And that's basically where we're at. And when I hear that, or I hear the Republican senator from Colorado, threaten to hold up judicial appointments or Justice Department appointments over this, I want to scream, instead of sniping about this, why not introduce legislation? Why not have it come from these libertarians on the right? Because it seems to me that state by state, I understand there's a lot of places where people still have strong objections, and I don't believe pot is benign. I don't think that anything that can alter your perceptions like that and have that kind of a physiological impact on you is completely benign, but neither is wine or beer or anything else, so it is what it is. But the bottom line is we should be moving to fix the law rather than just sniping around the periphery.
My goodness, I couldn't have said it better myself. We just had our annual meeting a couple weeks ago, and the board directed me in the same direction. And, you know, I think we've got to figure out how this can change at the federal level. I think California Republicans, Mr. McClintock, Mr. McCarthy, Mr. Valadeo, I think those are the folks that can lead on this issue and help bring some common sense back to our neighborhoods and cities.
You know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of when gay marriage was being booted around in referendums and court cases, et cetera, and ballot measures. And then all of a sudden, Joe Biden sort of went off and just ran his trap and supported gay marriage ahead of President Obama. And it actually forced President Obama to take a stand. That's what I really think has to happen. Somebody on the right has just got to take the lead on this, because as long as the left does it, it'll get lost in partisan politics, et cetera, et cetera. And I would really like to see that happen because, there, you know, first of all, it's the right thing to do in terms of law for free people. And more importantly, at least removes one major challenge to the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, which starts picking at some very, very – these aren't threads. These are cables that hold the country together, and they're not frivolous things.
I agreed entirely. I mean, it absolutely, it's time for this law to change, and it needs to be the law. It shouldn't be, in the Department of Justice hands. It shouldn't be a regulatory decision, executive decision. American law, federal law needs to change on this subject. And then, you know, we wouldn't be having this fight here in court in Sacramento. We wouldn't be challenging the Department of Food and Agriculture. This is a symptom of a failed law at the federal level.
You know, Abraham Lincoln said that the quickest way to repeal a bad law is rigorous enforcement. Because if you have a bad law and you really crack down and start enforcing it, all of a sudden people are going to change. You know who did this? When Theodore Roosevelt was the police commissioner in New York City many, many moons ago, the law said that bars and alcohol establishments couldn't serve on Sundays. It was a prohibition law on the books in New York City. And when Roosevelt became police commissioner, he started to enforce it. And he didn't believe in the law. He didn't support the law, but he said, I can't pick and choose which laws I like and choose to enforce or not enforce them. Change the law. And you know what? After about a year of rigorous enforcement, they changed the law.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Maybe it'll take Jeff Sessions coming in and busting a bunch of people to get this going. Thanks for coming on and talking to us about it. We'll continue to chat with you, okay?
Yeah, absolute pleasure. Anytime.
Okay.
Be well.
Thanks so much. CalGrowersAssociation.com. This has been Spotlight on the Community, 95.5 KLOS. I'm Doug McIntyre, Talk Radio 790 KBC AM.